I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from Dubai in the UAE. Tomorrow is 11 years to the day Crimea acceded to the Russian Federation after an overwhelming vote at a referendum opposed by NATO nations that had conspired to overthrow the legitimate government of Ukraine. But today, as the Trump and Putin governments apparently seek peace, Western European vassals of Washington look set to continue their proxy war. And today's OECD projections of near-term prospects for the global economy may not fully take into account what Starmer, Macron and Merz of Britain, France and Germany said over the weekend. With almost half of the world's population on less than $7 a day, NATO's European countries already self-sanctioning are hell-bent on war, set to further impoverish their populations. It's a far cry from what economist J. Maynard Keynes wanted nearly a century ago, that incomes should rise and basic needs should be met. Joining me now from London is one of the greatest economic historians of the 20th century, the award-winning biographer of John Maynard Keynes, Emeritus Professor of Political Economy at Warwick University, Lord Skidelsky. Lord Skidelsky, thank you so much for coming back on the show. Very rare, let alone in The Guardian, which all but fired the late John Pilger, friend of this show. And I should say, I began my journalism career on that paper. Very rare for scepticism about NATO in Ukraine as a subject to read any dissent. You've written something, they published it. Tell me about the shambles, as you characterise UK policy on Ukraine. Now Britain is set to, I don't know, send soldiers to fight Russia.
Well, the word shambles is right. I think the whole of our policy was based on a lie, in a way, which is that we'd come to the help of Ukraine, whatever it took. And the point is, we were never prepared to come to the help of Ukraine, whatever it took. That is, to give enough support to Ukraine for them to achieve a victory over Russia. So there was always that element of deception there. And gradually it became more palpable Ukraine wasn't actually doing so well in the war from 2024 onwards. So this idea that we were going to do whatever it took to achieve a Ukrainian victory became not only more and more false, but also more and more immoral, because we were actually encouraging the fighting to go on rather than actively seeking some way of ending it. And all that was changed by the victory of Donald Trump, which left Britain and the European allies of Britain without a policy, without plausible policy, how to insert themselves into this new game. And I think that's what's been obsessing the Prime Minister and the British government since the election of Donald Trump.
But what you just said there, I think, would be recognised by many in the global south, certainly, and in the most of the world, but doesn't seem to be recognised very much in our country. Britain, you say in the piece, you've been writing about this, you had scant interest from British publications. I don't know what it's like to be in the House of Lords listening to these speeches. Why is it that you seem such a lone voice when you're not backing Russia, you're not backing Ukraine, you're just backing Britain?
Well, there are lots of sort of, lots of reasons for this, and they come together. I mean, one is, of course, you'd call it an imperial reflex, that, you know, Britain was a lawgiver to much of the world in the 19th century, and then it handed over to America. And so the idea is that Britain and America must always be together. As long as the Biden administration was a sort of, you know, a passive warmonger, I'd say, fully in support of Ukraine and against Russia, then I think Britain felt it had to follow there. So that was one strand in it. There was also what I call the Munich reflex, which is that Britain surrendered a bit of Czechoslovakia to Hitler in 1938, and it felt great shame at doing this, because in a way it unleashed the Second World War. And so one of the things that you heard again and again in Parliament and in the press is the comparison of President Putin to Hitler, that what you can't give anything or he'll want more and more and more. So, I mean, that's a second strand. And the third is a sort of legal moral strand. Russia did invade Ukraine, and that was contrary to the kind of legal and moral system that we had lived with, so to speak. And so they felt Russia was the aggressor and shouldn't be in any way rewarded. I mean, I think I'm trying to just give you an idea of the British mindset during the course of the war. Well, then, of course, once it became clear that Ukraine wasn't going to beat Russia, once it became clear that to give more and more weapons and more deadly weapons to Ukraine was to risk escalation to the point when you started to fear a nuclear exchange, at that point, British policy had nowhere to go, really. And this is where I think Trump has broken through.
On that second issue, because you personally know a little bit about it, on the moral issue, how do they square that with their support of the war on Yugoslavia? You, of course, resigned, I think, from your position in the House of Lords over Kosovo.
Well, you know, don't expect consistency from politicians or from governments. No, I mean, of course, in that sense...
You might have to explain that, because people won't remember what NATO did then.
Well, you're talking of the bombing of Yugoslavia in 1997, and that was contrary to... It wasn't authorised by the United Nations. It was a NATO operation. And it gives the lie to the idea, I think, that NATO is a purely defensive organization. I think if you're also trying to work out what the Russian attitude has been, it's been ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union, there's been a consistent opposition to the eastward expansion of NATO. That's running consistently from Gorbachev, Yeltsin, Putin. And that's always been met by the argument that NATO is a purely defensive organization, that there's nothing to fear. And this is simply this idea is that NATO is a sort of encircling beast, is something conjured up by the Russians to justify their attempts to regain lost territory, you know, after 1991. So you have that narrative. I think the other case you can raise is, of course, the operation in Iraq. There's always an idea behind NATO, not only to defend the bits of territory that NATO alliance covered, but to increase the NATO world, so that, you know, more and more people would you know, accept our values, our rules, and so on. So I think those are the elements driving British policy. They don't drive European policy quite as much, but they do drive British policy.
Yeah, so those three different prongs that you itemise in the article. So what... as regards how they excuse their behaviour. So what does it make you personally feel when you hear the phrase unprovoked? Because you've been saying throughout that this is NATO expansionism, which is usually talked about as a Putin puppet talking point, Kremlin talking point. When you hear that phrase, the unprovoked aggression, what do you feel about that? And what do you feel about how it's used so widely by journalists, let alone the politicians and lords and ladies in the House of Lords?
You know, you get a narrative, and that narrative has cliches attached to it. And one of the cliches is unprovoked. It's just the adjective. You have to use that adjective now. It's unprovoked. The other adjective, which of course is always used, is full scale. The unprovoked full scale aggression of Russia against Ukraine. Those terms are all linked together, and they're just repeated as a mantra. And in fact, journalists don't have any other vocabulary when they want to write about this. They come to these terms. Now, listening to it as a sort of, I think, as an intelligent person capable of thinking for himself, I cringe when I hear it. I mean, I cringe whenever I hear these cliches. And of course, Russia was provoked. Of course, Russia was provoked. I always argue that being provoked does not justify everything that Russia did. That you can be provoked, and there are different ways of responding to provocation. So that doesn't mean I'm a 100% follower of what Russia's done, but I do try to understand the mindset of the people taking these actions. And I cannot accept the idea that the invasion was unprovoked, or indeed that it was full scale.
Well, I mean, come on. You know these people that are saying the phrase in the House of Lords, certainly in the House of Parliament. I mean, clearly it isn't full scale because, we hope it doesn't happen, but they have the largest nuclear arsenal on Earth.
Yeah, well, what can you do? How can you attack a cliche? I mean, once it's lodged in the mind, events are the only things that can blow it out of the mind. Finally, events don't live up to this particular world that you've created, and the world then disintegrates. And something like that's happening at the moment. There is obviously going to be a compromise peace. The bits of it are starting to come together. It's left British policy in ruins.
Yeah, I want to explore that a bit later, but on this other element of your piece, on the Hitler-Putin point, I mean, it's obviously very offensive to Russians. And I tell you, in Britain, when going underground, this programme was made in Britain, our lawyers told us in defence against the government censorship agency, Ofcom, that if we mentioned 27 million Russians killed in World War II, we had to put a strap saying, but Stalin made a pact with Hitler. So, the Molotov Pact. In the same way, you're suggesting that somehow the UK Nazi Pact, which it was de facto, of Munich and Chamberlain, this somehow has such a part in haunting the imagination of the elites in our country.
Yeah, it does. You hear it time and again, not only in the press, but occasion, but in parliamentary speeches. It's the basic idea behind it, I think, is that democracy is the peaceful form of government, and dictatorship is the violent form of government. So once you label someone a dictator, you assume that that dictator's aims are expansionist. And the dictators with which Britain was particularly involved in the making of its memory, or the dictator, was Hitler. And so they feel that they really unleashed the Second World War by giving way to Hitler, and we must never do it again. You see, they don't try to analyze what it was that Russia wanted in this war. It's just assumed that it was a game they were playing to really dominate not only their own near abroad, but also bits of Europe that they'd once had and had given up. So they assume, the phrase you have is, if we allow Putin to get away with it, he will be emboldened to then go further to Georgia, to Moldova, to the Baltic states, possibly to Poland. And if he gets all that, then who knows where he will want to go.
Lord Skidelsky, I'll stop you there. More from the Crossbench Life Peer, an emeritus professor of political economy, after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the Emeritus Professor of Political Economy at Warwick University and award-winning biographer John Maynard Keynes, Lord Skidelsky. Lord Skidelsky, I interrupted you in part one when you were talking about this wild imagination in the British elite mind of Putin, Russian expansionism. It's not just the fears of the invasion of Poland. I mean, I hear it spoken about in our media, the mainstream so-called media in Britain, that somehow he's going to be marching through the Kurfürstendamm, the Champs-Élysées and Whitehall. I mean, what sort of mania is it that they think that the very specific reasons for the Ukraine conflict are something to do with the idea of Russia wanting to invade London?
It's completely decontextualized, you see. There's, first of all, no one knows, very few people who write about these things know about the specific situation in Ukraine. Very few of them know about the specific situation in Russia. Hardly any of them speak any Russian at all. They don't know anything about any of this. And all they have are these abstract ideas, which is dictatorship means war, and Putin is a vainglorious expansionist, that you can't trust anything a dictator says because they're always going to break their word. And therefore, you have to fight. And therefore, you have to be prepared to fight everywhere. Now, there's a kind of paranoia, as you say, about the expansionist aims of Russia, so that you may have to fight. You may have to fight in Western Europe, not necessarily in the old form, but there's cyber warfare, there are all kinds of hybrid warfare, and you have to rearm. The phrase is, Ukraine has been a wake-up call. We have to rearm Britain and Western Europe to deal with this danger.
And of course, the wider public, I mean, I should say I don't speak Russian, but I mean, you can see this stuff online if the censorship in Britain doesn't allow any other competing narrative. They're about to discover, the wider public, what this is going to mean, aren't they? And they're starting to understand it. I mean, you're one of the greatest economic historians, as I said, of the 20th century. How easily is the British public going to understand a... they've already been cutting the heating of homes' benefits for old people. They still have that two-child policy for people on welfare. And they're going to end disability benefits for the severely disabled, or at least there's talk about it, all as a need to curb the deficit so that they can fund weapons and the military to fight Russia.
Yeah, you know, there's something very, very cynical here. At the moment, they're trapped by their fiscal rules, so-called fiscal rules. You shouldn't spend any more over a certain period than you get in revenue. So these are fiscal rules. So defense breaks these fiscal rules. What's going on is something I think we would recognize as military Keynesianism. You can't justify large state expenditures for welfare or things of this kind. You have to cut those because we can't afford it. But as soon as you raise the question of national security, everything becomes affordable. And that's what's really happening now. The Germans are breaking their fiscal rules in order to boost their defence. The British will be breaking their fiscal rules in order to get more money for defence. And the justification of everything is Ukraine, you see.
So yeah, but when it comes to military Keynesianism, usually, I don't know whether FDR did the same, you kind of hide it. I mean, the Biden administration was explicit. They said, OK, whatever it's for, it benefits manufacturing jobs at home. Why is it they're saying the quiet part out loudly? I mean, do they just take the publics? Does Macron, Mertz and Starmer take their publics just for utter fools? And will these populations accept it? That somehow this is the best way of starting to rejuvenate an economy that has been self-sanctioning, military Keynesianism.
Yeah, well, you see, the best way to get an economy booming is always to spend a lot of money on military things, because everyone agrees security must come first. As far as I know, the Russian economy is boomed quite a bit since the Ukraine war. I mean, the thing is, you can justify expenditures by saying that you're at war. It's the oldest strategy of governments since the beginning of time. Go to war, you spend a lot of money, get a lot of jobs, a lot of things, war equipment being manufactured, and the economy booms. It doesn't grow in the end because, of course, it's waste. I mean, all this military stuff is, strictly speaking, consumption. It's not investment. But nevertheless, while it's going on, there's a terrific feeling of, optimism. And it's in a good cause, because what better cause is there than the security of your nation?
And there's a huge fight back of Friedrich Hayek against J. Maynard Keynes. And since you are the expert on Keynes, I suppose I better ask, presumably Keynes himself did not ever coin a term like military Keynesianism, and that wasn't the point at all of what he thought of as a way to make all our lives better after the Second World War.
No, I mean, it wasn't. And Keynes also, in international relations, and this is a point I'd like to make when I'm talking about Keynes, he very much believed in prudence. He said, you mustn't really go to war lightly in any way, because you're risking disrupting anything sort of that works in the world. And so he was always a sort of, I say, a functional pacifist, Keynes was. He said, don't wrap up your war rhetoric. Don't get people into the mood that they want to fight, because you're going to destroy more than you're going to gain in most cases. I mean, that was his attitude. And I think that's why I'm so against the bellicose character of our rhetoric over the last two or three years. I mean, it's been really very belligerent. We are a co-belligerent of Ukraine. We're not at war with Russia, but we're what's called a co-belligerent of Ukraine. And that means you damn Russia the whole time. And to me, that is awful, because it means diplomacy is out of the window. You can't, if you call someone a war criminal, you can't negotiate with them. It's obvious.
Except that the as long as it takes phrase used by Starmer, Macron and Merz and other European Union leaders, of course, the European Union Foreign Minister Kaya Kallas, doesn't seem to acknowledge that Russia has the largest nuclear number of nuclear bombs on Earth. That's just not been part of the debate, that Russia...
No, he's bluffing. He's bluffing. That's all. That's... When you have these generals coming on, the armchair warriors as well as retired generals coming out and saying we must sort of give Ukraine everything it takes, and then you say, well, what about the threat of escalation and retaliation? Oh, he's bluffing, they say. We don't need to take that seriously.
And so Sorry, go ahead.
No, that's been the level of it.
And these three elements, domino theory, the Putin-Hitler thing, the special relationship. The reason why there was so much outrage in the European Union and Britain about the Oval Office spat with Zelensky sitting there was because, first of all, Trump had called him dictator. Trump keeps on going on about the threat of World War III, and he's literally demolishing all the three elements of the context in which European populations have been led to believe war through Ukraine must be the future for Europe till kingdom come.
Yeah, he shredded the narrative. He shredded the script on which our public life has been based in this particular area for the last 3 years. And the problem for our prime minister and Britain, and to a lesser extent for other, is how to insert themselves into the new script. And various things they've tried to do have obviously been non-starters. I mean, one is to get a coalition of the willing, that is Britain, France and maybe one or two other NATO countries to police the ceasefire and therefore get into Ukraine. Well, that was never going to work. First of all, Russia was never going to accept
it. Why did they say it then?
Why? Because it was a way of trying to make themselves relevant to a process from which they're being excluded.
And actually, you end the piece on irrelevance and the risk of irrelevance. Do you think Britain is basically irrelevant, despite all the now attempts by Europe to say, look, we're going to go it alone now. We're going to go it alone into the world against Washington, against Moscow, against Beijing, against everyone, against... That's what the European Union and Britain are going to be alone.
Well, you see, the basic, again, it's a language trap, isn't it? They talk about Europe as though Europe was an equivalent state to the United States or Russia or China. Europe isn't. It's a collection of nations and in a confederal union. There is no European government. So when people talk about Europe must... gear up its effort. It's as though there's a European government, a minister of defense, a foreign minister, and the apparatus of a state. Now, if that was so, then of course you can talk to the resources, add them all up. You see, Europe had 400 million people. It has, huge economic resources. Therefore, why isn't it autonomous? And the reason it's not autonomous is it can't get mobilize those resources. There's no way it can do so. And therefore, it's been, in effect, Western Europe, a protectorate of the United States.
Lord Skidelsky, thank you. That's it for the show. We'll be back with a brand new episode on Saturday. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.